It is 26 and one half minutes after the hour, that hour being 9 a.m. here in the Central Time Zone of the U.S. And it's a Thursday, and that means that we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, lives in Ashburn, Virginia. He's got a brand new church in Fairfax, Virginia. And you've been there for just the head pastor, the chief, the uppermost in the church there, Robbie.
Unofficially this month. Officially, Sunday is the installation or institution. Uh-huh. Depends on, you know, choose. You want to be installed like a sink or instituted, or institutionalized.
So it's like you've been on probation up to this point? Is that the idea?
Well, it's just been unofficial because the bishop has not come and done the formal installation service or service of institution where mm-hmm. I'll officially become the rector. But I've been on board for the last month and a half, you know, onboarding, getting things going. But it's great to be with you, Jim and David, today. Thanks for having me on The Broken Road.
Well, it's kind of we got a fun topic today, too. And I sent you this article, and I know you have a passion for archaeology, as do I. Mm. In fact, I remember, do you know Pastor John Delaney from Pennsylvania?
Name sounds familiar, but I don't know that I have.
Well, I know he was familiar with Doug Greenwald, and we used to have him on the air. We would talk archaeology, and because nice. That's what he does, and it was so fascinating. But the trouble with talking about archaeology every week is it doesn't happen that fast. So
it's a very slow process, mm-hmm. the archaeological process of digging a site.
Eventually he decided, well, let's not do that because I'm having trouble coming up with new material for you. So that's fine. But he's still involved. He still has his church and happily involved in archaeology in trips to Israel. But this came to my attention via the Biblical Archaeological Society, and they've discovered, uncovered, I don't know how this works, but a farm that dates back to the 2nd century B.C. and the Hasmonean dynasty, which is a time when the Greeks, who had been running that area since Alexander the Great, were in the process of meeting their comeuppance at the hands of the Hebrews, who eventually, after 15 years of warfare, threw them out. And there's a link to this story, by the way, in the chat window at BrokenRoadRadio.com if anybody wants to look this up. It says an interesting short article. But it appears that the people left this site, which had been cultivated and farmed probably for some 700 years from the clues they found, left in haste, probably, very possibly, because of a military threat of some kind. And there was warfare raging back and forth across the Galilee during this time period. Mm. And that conforms nicely with what we know from secular history. But that's kind of a blank spot in Bible history. It's covered by some of the writing of the Maccabees and some of the other books that are included in Catholic Bibles. What's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, the Apocrypha. Apocryphal, the intertestamental period. The 400. They call it the 400 years of silence, but I don't quite like that mm-hmm. because God is not silent. And you can't mistake silence for
Well, they
absence.
Say that because there were no recorded prophets during that time.
That's
no word from God in the literature, at least, which has always disturbed me because so much was going on, so much that's relevant to the development of later Christianity and the coming of the Messiah and so forth. So let's talk about how archaeology relates to the Bible. Why the blank spot there? I mean, there's so much history in the Old Testament, dates and places and cities and people's names and times, and then all of a sudden, quiet. How do you explain that?
Yeah, and that intertestamental period is not, it's not that it's silent. I mean, even the apocryphal books, are, while they may not be canonical, they certainly are telling the history of God's people from, you know, the time of 500s, when the people returned from exile in Babylon up until the birth of Jesus. So this archaeological find in that article with biblicalarchaeology.org, one of my favorite websites, by the way, and really cheap subscriptions to get to biblicalarchaeology.org.
It's a great resource, too. They're
fun. It's a wonderful resource. And this archaeological find of this town is a continuation of a farmstead from the Hasmonean era. So you're talking 147 BC or BCE to 37 CE or AD, as we would call it, but common era. So that's happening. This archaeological find is probably a mid-second century is what they're thinking, but it is a continuation of this farmstead that's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so when I think about archaeological finds and archaeological places, they do confirm the biblical narrative, but what they also do is they hold a theology of place. They give us a snapshot, a glimpse of what life looked like. And in this instance, we can really get an idea of what life looked like in an agrarian culture and agricultural society in the time of Jesus.
Which is something that few of us understand here in the West. And I know Doug Greenwald made that point over and over and over with us, is that our Western view, the paradigms we have, don't match up with how people in the Middle East in that time period, in Bible times, actually saw the world. And would interpret the events of the world, which is why digging old farms up now is so important, because for one thing, it establishes a commonality. They were human. This is how they lived day to day. We now know some of those details. They're no longer just images out of the past, but we can relate to them with a sense of true understanding, getting by that old Western paradigm.
Absolutely. And just in this find alone is steel, iron implements like plows and pruning hooks and all these different implements, farm implements that are mentioned throughout the biblical narrative, but specifically Jesus growing up in Nazareth, which is a small town in the Galilee region, and this town in particular was found in the Galilean region. It gives us insight into Jesus' teaching, because most of the time Jesus was using farming analogies, he was using agricultural language, he was using
sheep and vineyards, yeah, and fishing, and he was a rural kind of guy.
So he pointed. When Jesus taught, he pointed. Consider the lilies. He pointed at the lilies. I am sure of it. He gestured at these things. When he said, if someone puts his hand to the plow and looks back, he's not fit for the kingdom. Well, that's an image that everyone knows. If you don't keep your eye where the plow is going and you look back, you're going to be plowing in circles. You're going to get crooked rows. So these images that Jesus uses in his teaching are all wrapped up into this agricultural society. So we're finding a farm like this that's literally, as the article states, frozen in time. We get to time travel. The beauty of archaeology is it literally digs up the place, and you can time travel and go back and see what life was like for those in the first century.
Now, this is being done by the Israeli archaeological, what's the name of the organization?
It's Israeli Antiquities
Authority. I know for the longest time, and since the mid-19th century, when archaeology really became a big thing, and one of the reasons people flocked to the Middle East was to try their best to verify through archaeological digs and research what the Bible had to say. For example, identifying all those place names that come to us from the Old Testament. And through 150 years now, or 180 years of archaeological work, some of it less than scientific, but since the 1890s and onward, science really got a hold on it. They have done nothing to refute anything in the Bible. In fact, they've verified most all of the locations mentioned in the Old Testament through archaeological research. But they haven't talked to each other. That used to be a thing about archaeologists. It was like, this is my prize, this is my reputation, this is my paper, this is my research grant. I'm not going to share the information. Do they share information these days? I mean, how can you not?
Yeah, there is more interdisciplinary conversation happening. There's more integration in the different fields. And it's less protective. It's more open source, if we should use that word.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important in an information age that we are more open source and the disciplines help each other. But you're correct that the archaeological evidence validates the biblical narrative. They do not contradict each other. As a matter of fact, the archaeological evidence actually validates the biblical narrative, and the biblical narrative, in some cases, like the digging up of Hazor, when archaeologists...
That's a city in the north of Galilee there.
Yeah. That's right. Still the Galilee region. The biblical narrative validated or gave name to that city, because there was a burn layer in Joshua, actually, during the days of Joshua, that city was burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so when archaeologists discovered it and wondered about that burn layer, the biblical narrative gave insight to them to know what they were looking at. So it's important. Theology of place is important. The evangelical triangle is where Jesus spent 80% of his life and ministry in the Galilee region. That becomes very important, that this particular archaeological discovery was in Galilee, because it does give us insight of what the agricultural society looked like in the time of Jesus, because, again, most of Jesus's life and ministry was there in Galilee. So when you're reading the scriptures, when you're reading and looking at Jesus's teaching, it's important to ask these questions. Have you ever asked the question, well, why was Jesus born in the day that he was born, in the era that he was born? Why was he born in that place, the exact place where he was born? Why was he born and his father was a carpenter? Why was Jesus himself a carpenter? When you begin to ask these questions, I believe that there is a certain theology of place. And we, in our Western mindset, we don't really have roots in place the way that the biblical authors and the biblical characters, the people in the Bible, had roots in the earth, in the actual geographical location, the topographical location, the geological location, the actual dirt, the place on the map. And that's the beauty of archaeology. It gets us into the place. So when you begin to study something like farm country around the Sea of Galilee, the region of Galilee, well, even the Judeans in the time of Jesus, you can see this in John chapter 7, there's a dialogue between Nicodemus and the religious leaders. And when Nicodemus comes to Jesus' defense, they're quipped to Nicodemus, the religious leaders, as they insult Nicodemus and Jesus. They do it with these words. They say to Nicodemus, are you also a Galilean like Jesus is? Search the scriptures and you will find that no prophet comes from Galilee. Now, you can hear echoes in that of the words from Nathanael, can anything good come out of Nazareth?
That was coming to my mind, because it seems to me, and in a lot of the explanation, when Jesus is teaching to groups of people being followed by crowds, many of them are up from Judea. They have come up to Galilee to hear him, or maybe they were there on vacation. Maybe that was a getaway place, because they couldn't go south. That's forbidding land in the far south of Israel. Yeah. So people from the city, like they still do today, went to the countryside, to the mountains, to get away from the urban environment in Jerusalem, which was really not a huge city as we know huge cities, but it was, I'm told, something close to maybe 20,000 people during non-festival times. You know,
maybe they were camping. David said maybe they were camping. Well, I think a lot of life actually resembled camping back in the first century, David. I think some of these homes that they're even excavating, you've got it better in your camper out in the woods than some of these guys had it in these little stone homes. So, yes, the first century in the region of Galilee, it's a slower pace farm community. I say slower pace, but they worked all the time, sun up to sun down.
But they had the reputation of being rubes, country folk, simple-minded people, at least from the standpoint of the city of Jerusalem.
And then in Jerusalem, there is the temple. So there's religious snobbery, and you can hear it in the voice of these religious leaders when they insult Nicodemus. Now, I want to pick apart this question, because it's an important one. Search the scriptures and you will see that no prophet has ever come from Galilee, this insult that they give. to Nicodemus, insulting him, calling him a Galilean in reference to Jesus being a Galilean. So did a prophet ever come from the region of Galilee is the great question we should be asking. What is the significance of this little farm country, and does it matter? And I would say it's of utmost significance. And let's take Jesus's own words. Remember in John's gospel, when Jesus is asked for a sign, they say, give us a sign that we might know that you are the Messiah. And Jesus says, I'm not going to give you any sign except for the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Now, to many of us, that's a throwaway line. But if you research the prophet Jonah, you will find that the prophet Jonah himself is from a little Galilean town called Gath Hepher. Now, if Jonah is a prophet of the Most High God from Galilee, by insulting Jesus, calling him a Galilean, and insulting that geographical region, saying there's no prophet from there, they are actually rejecting the prophet Jonah, the canonical, as we know it now, the Old Testament canonical minor prophet Jonah.
Well, that brings up a geographical question in my mind then. Is the region of Galilee is it the same territory that comprised the northern kingdom of Israel during the divided kingdom period? So, because there were prophets from the northern kingdom, Isaiah and Amos and maybe others, which these people who were saying, maybe they forgot their own history.
Okay, but they can be a prophet to there and not be a prophet from there. And so we have to make that distinction. So in other words, I can be like I live in Northern Virginia. I'm a pastor in Northern Virginia. I can be a priest to Fairfax, Virginia at Shepherd's Heart Anglican Church, but I'm not from there. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina. I'm a Southerner. So I'm from that kind of backwoods country, and now I'm in this, you know, big city north.
Well, no, so it's, Robbie, no need for apologies here.
I don't apologize. Too late for apologies. All right. So no, but the point is, I am a servant or a priest to this place, but I am not from there. So there can be prophets to the north that are not from the north, to your point. Now, we do know that Jonah is a prophet of God, and he is from Galilee. So in this instance, yes, the religious leaders do not understand the history of this prophet, or if you know your history, they are actually rejecting the prophet Jonah. And Jesus is saying, I am coming. The one sign I'm going to give you is the prophet Jonah. In other words, I'm not rejecting the prophet Jonah. Now, why are they rejecting Jonah? Well, it's simple. Because the Assyrians were the enemies of Israel, and the Assyrians were the first to attack the northern kingdom. And when the Assyrians invade, when the northern kingdom was split from the southern kingdom in the days after the days of Solomon, the United Monarchy, this northern kingdom is invaded by Assyria, God's enemies, and they're destroyed. And when the Assyrians invade you, they occupy you.
And that was like 8th century B.C.
722. Mm-hmm. So they mixed in marriage. This is where the Samaritans come from, this remnant of the Assyrians. So the Judeans, the Jews, do not like the prophet Jonah because he is the prophet to speak repentance to Nineveh, the capital of Assyria.
Geographical and historical context comes together there and informs us and beautifully verifies, authenticates, corroborates what's in the Bible. So I have another question for you. There's another article. In fact, if it sounds familiar to some of our listeners, Dr. Don and we on Tuesday were kind of talking about the same article. It has to do with the the utilization of general revelation. Tell us what that means, and why do we use it?
Yeah. General revelation in juxtaposition to special revelation. Special revelation, God's written, inspired word, is God's specific or special revelation. God's general revelation is what we see in the scriptures when the Bible says, the heavens declare the glory of God. Day to day gives forth speech that creation is speaking. General revelation is more that God's invisible attributes, as Paul says in Romans, can be clearly seen through the things that he has made. So that is a general revelation.
Okay, now here's the clinker. This is the problem, because I've long felt through my life that you could come to a knowledge of God, maybe a convincing knowledge of God, maybe a love of God through general revelation alone. That is, by observing what he's created and putting that together with your human experience and at least getting into the matter of the existence of God. And at what point do you need the Bible? Because you do need the Bible.
Yeah. General revelation is not enough. The gentleman who discipled me, named Tom Craig, one of the ways that he discipled me back in high school was to ask me how I knew what I knew about God, because I had a general revelation about God. I had a prayer life. I walked the streets at night by myself. I loved evenings and the full moon and a nice spring or fall evening where the weather was perfect, the sky was clear, the stars were out, full moon, and the prayer life was intimate and close. And I had conversations with God, and those were some of the closest times I've felt to God. And so I had some ideas about who I thought God was. Certainly magnificent, certainly a creator, certainly big. All these different things we would say about God is magnificent. He's a creator. He's almighty. He's completely other. He's outside of his creation. He's large. But my discipler began to ask me the question, well, how do you know? And what's your chapter and verse? Because what he was trying to do is he was trying to link general revelation with specific revelation. And I remember the turning point. I remember being stressed out as a teenager and him encouraging me to read my Bible. And I read Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus said, sufficient for today is today's own trouble. And I remember it's like a practical realist reading that passage and saying, gosh, that just makes perfect sense. Sufficient is for today is today's own trouble. So I dove into the Sermon on the Mount and realized, you know, that Jesus lived in this world. The things that we're talking about with theology of place, when he began to say, consider the lilies, when he began to say that they neither toil nor spin, yet your heavenly Father takes care of them, I began to link the nature piece, what I had been observing in general revelation, with the theological piece that there is a maker and caretaker and someone who cares for his creation. That special revelation linked with the general revelation, it's like listening in stereo. If you've ever had one of your earbuds fall out of your ear and you're listening in one ear versus in two, there's a difference in the sound and the completeness of the experience when you're listening in stereo versus mono. And that becomes important in our theology, that we have a general revelation, certainly, but also that's a beginning point. We need special revelation. It's like that in a marriage relationship. We all begin with attraction. Woohoo! Mm-hmm. I got to get to know her or him. and then once you do, that's a good start. That's general revelation. But then you really fall in love when you begin the relationship and have the special revelation of someone's words and someone's personality, and you enter into that actual relationship.
I need to speak and confirm what you're saying, because the springboard into being a believer for me was when I was about 14 years old, And mom made me go to youth class from a local congregational church, a pastor, Carlton Whitlatch. I still remember him. Chain smoker. He eventually died of emphysema and was a grumpy old man, from what I understand. But at the time I was with him, we all talked about what life means to us, kind of thing. And at the end of the session, one simple sentence, he said, "Life is too beautiful just to end."
Yeah.
And that soaked in. But it wasn't until another 20 years of researching and thinking and praying and trying to relate to God, and finally having some committed Christians around me where I worked, that I had this sudden desire to pick up the Bible and read it. I could not put it down until I had read the entire thing. At which point I asked, "What was that?" I couldn't figure out where to go. So I do it. You do it again, and then you go into specifics. So the Bible is essential to the whole experience. But you can be brought to that edge by general revelation. I think I'm wondering if that's how most people. David, what's your experience with that? Are you there, David?
I couldn't get my mic activated. I was thinking about what you talked about, and I forgot the question.
David, I was working with a friend of mine.
Go ahead.
I was working with a friend of mine yesterday. He had needed some help with a chair, and I walked into his apartment there, and there was this electrical massaging recline chair that was in like four massive pieces. And my general revelation was, I think I know how to help him put this together. And so, like a typical, I don't know if I'm being, you know, sexist or stereotypical here, but as a typical male, I dove right in without the instruction manual. And I got that thing 90% of the way done. and that ain't bad.
That's not bad, yeah.
For general revelation. But the problem is I had a handful of screws, two brackets, and I was missing some plugs to plug this thing in. Mm-hmm. So I decided I'd pick up the instruction manual. And that's when it began to be real. I realized that two of the plugs were still hidden under the chair. I had to dig them out to plug them in, or that chair was not going to function, number one. Number two, the two brackets I had in my hand were an anti-tip bracket. Had I not installed them, my friend's wife,
who we were
putting this together for, would have been backwards on the living room floor. So
she'd be tipping over,
Yeah. So general revelation is great, but we need a little something more. And what the Bible offers us is specific general, it's more than general revelation, it's specific detailed instructions. You know, some people have said the Bible is just simply BIBLE, basic instructions before leaving the earth. I think it's more than that, but it's a cute way to say it is an instruction manual. There are things in there that without that special revelation, we can't make sense of the God of the universe.
Well, sometimes with the special revelations, you go back and rework some of your general revelation assumptions and experiences. And it's a correction process, bit by bit by bit. And I think it's, I don't know, if you don't have a good Bible at hand, and maybe several, you're at a great disadvantage in trying to understand what's going on out there in the real world. Because it is the real world, and archaeology helps us inform that. The Bible history informs archaeology, which in turn corroborates Bible history, as it turns out. It's a fascinating thing. Pastor Robbie Pruitt, a member of the board at Preserving Bible Times, preservingbibletimes.org is the website. There you'll find lots of information, both written and video, that will increase your knowledge of biblical context, meaning teach you what's in between the lines, and fill in all those wrong assumptions you may have made if you've just depended upon general revelation. So just thought I would mention that. You can link to them from our website at brokenroadradio.com, preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, thanks so much.
It's a joy to be with you, Jim and David. It's a real book with real people and real places and real time.
It is indeed. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.
care.
See you, Robbie.
Great to be here.